Welcome to Linguistic Voices on Campus, a podcast series produced at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. This series deals with common beliefs about language. Linguistic experts will discuss these beliefs through the lens of their own research. My name is Anja Wanner. I'm a professor of English here. My guest today is Professor Monica McCauley from the Linguistics Department right here at University of Wisconsin-Madison. Professor McCauley's main area of research is the morphology, that is, the structure of words of Native American languages. She has done work on a variety of languages, including Menominee, that's an Algonquian language spoken here in Wisconsin. Today, she will tell us a bit about the structure of these languages, and she will also address the belief that some languages are more primitive than others. Welcome, Professor McCauley.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Professor McCauley, some people think that we can say that some languages are primitive. Presumably, a primitive language would be a language with not a lot of grammar, with a small vocabulary, not many words for complex ideas, and no writing system. From a linguistic viewpoint, can we even measure the complexity of language? And if we can, are there primitive languages?
Well, I'd have to start by giving you an unequivocal no. There are no primitive languages.
Glad to hear it.
I think all linguists start from the premise that all languages are created equal. You might find that in a given language, one area of its grammar is more simple, but I guarantee you if you go and look at some other area of its grammar, you're going to find out that that's more complicated than some other one. Let me take some of these points that you mentioned. I think a lot of people assume that a language is equivalent to its writing system. And this is, you know, it's an obvious conclusion to draw because of the way that we're educated. So much of our education focuses on reading and writing. But writing systems are really sociocultural accidents in a way. And they're really unrelated to the language itself.
Kind of arbitrary?
Yeah. I mean, I shouldn't say they're totally unrelated because the type of writing system that you get sometimes matches up with the type of language that it's developed for. But really, you can just think of writing systems as a frill that some cultures develop and some cultures don't. And they're completely separate from the language that the people speak. Any culture could develop a writing system, and some do and some don't. Now, this issue of not having many words for complex ideas, that actually always makes me laugh because working on Native American languages, which of course were thought to be primitive by so many people for so long, if you look at the words in Native American languages, they're often hugely complex. They cram pretty much everything that we would take a whole sentence to say into a single word. There's one that I always like to use in my introductory classes as an example that means, I am looking for something suitable for a fish line in one of the languages spoken in Alaska. And I'm not going to attempt to pronounce it because I have no clue how it's pronounced, but it's a single word. So this concept of words for complex ideas, it actually really is turned on its head when you start looking at the very, very complex words that you get in some of these languages. And then, of course, the other thing is if the idea is that, well, sure, that's complicated, but it's not words for abstract concepts, that too is completely untrue, because all of the languages of the world are going to have ways of expressing the abstract concepts having to do with the various religious beliefs mm-hmm. and rituals and myths, creation stories, that kind of stuff. The issue of a language not having a lot of grammar, I think what that stems from is a confusion between what linguists call prescriptive and descriptive grammar. And prescriptive grammar, of course, is what you get in school, and that's when your English teacher bops you on the head and says, don't end sentences with prepositions, or use whom. To whom did you give it? I mean, personally, I don't think I've ever uttered, to whom did you give it, unless I'm using it as an example in a linguistics class. Those are prescriptive rules. Descriptive rules are what linguists are interested in, and descriptive rules have to do with simply describing how people actually use language. And you might say, well, but then that's just a big mess and people, there are no rules and people don't follow rules when they talk, but they do. And that's the whole heart of what linguistics is that language is a rule-governed system. It's just not those prescriptive rules that your nasty English teacher always bangs you on the head and says you have to follow. So if you have languages that are not taught in schools and that don't have huge written traditions, you're less likely to develop this kind of set of prescriptive rules. And I think this is where this notion that languages that don't have a written tradition lack grammar comes from. They have grammar. Every language has grammar. Every language has an incredibly complex set of rules that its speakers all know and master and use all the time. What they may be lacking is the prescriptive tradition where a teacher tells you you have to talk one way and not another way. And frankly, I'd rather speak one of those languages, but that's just me.
And interestingly, the rules that people actually follow turn out to be much more complex than the prescriptive rules you find in grammar books.
Absolutely. We linguists would not have any jobs if they were really easy to figure out.
Can you tell us a bit about the languages that you study and what you find fascinating about them?
Well, I wrote my dissertation on Mixtec, which is an indigenous language of Mexico spoken in the highlands of Oaxaca. And I've also worked on a language called Karuk, which is spoken in Northern California, on Chinantec, which is another Mexican indigenous language, and on Menominee, which is spoken right here in Wisconsin, a little bit northwest of Green Bay. The reason that I just absolutely adore these languages is exactly what I was just talking about, which is that I'm a morphologist, which means that I work on the structure of words, and these languages have extremely complex words. What goes on is that a lot of the things that we're used to having to use separate words for, they just get glommed into the word with prefixes and suffixes. And so you make these gigantic, huge words by adding all these little pieces to each word. The other thing I think that's really fun is that the categories are really different. And you realize that there are just completely different ways of conceptualizing relationships that you took as very basic. So, for example, in Menominee, as in all of the Algonquian languages, it's belongs to the Algonquian language family. We're used to, you know, if you take French or Spanish or something like that, you're used to having to learn about the persons. You know, first person is mm-hmm. I, and second person is you, and third person is he, she, it. Well, in Algonquian languages, the third person gets divided into a subcategory of the main thing or person that you're talking about, and then everybody else. So if I'm telling a story in English and say it's about two women, and I say, well, you know, she did this, and then she did that, and then she did this, and then she did that, pretty soon you're going to get lost with which she is which. Mm-hmm. In Algonquian languages, there's two different pronouns for that. So the one who's the main character is what's called the proximate, and any other third person is what's called the obviative. So then you have to use a separate way of marking that non-main character in your story. So it disambiguates who you're referring to in the third person. So the things like that that, as an English speaker, I would simply never have thought of. And it's very fun to find those kinds of complexities.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a bit about language contact. Normally, when you have a minority language in a situation where there's also majority language, there's language contact and the languages will leave imprints on each other. A case in point is English. After the Norman invasion, French was established as the language of power in England, and many words were adopted from French into English. And sometimes they meant basically the same that an English word meant that already existed. So, for example, we have ox and beef and sheep and mutton and child and infant, and these are almost synonyms, and one word is German-based and the other word is French-based. Do we see any influence of Native American languages on English or vice versa?
We do. The obvious thing that you notice is the loan words into English for all kinds of things that the explorers found in the New World that they didn't have words for. So we have tons of words like moccasin and kayak and bayou and toboggan that were borrowed from various Native American languages. And then the place names often are. So my favorite one is the one that we all mispronounce when we first see it written, which is Shawano, spelled Shawano, so it looks like Shawano, mm-hmm. but it's actually pronounced Shawano. And that's the word for south in Menominee. And the town of Shawano is, in fact, just south of the Menominee Reservation. Wisconsin has wonderful place names that are, many of them are taken from Native American languages spoken in this state.
Is the pronunciation changed when it's borrowed into English?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. So Shawano, I don't know exactly how we came to that pronunciation in English, but it's Sawano in, mm-hmm. in Menominee. So yeah, the pronunciation is usually changed quite a bit. Just like, you know, French yeah. place names, you know, Fond du Lac. It's my favorite.
Paris de Chine.
Yeah, Paris de Chine. There are more subtle things, too, in terms of the influence, more abstract influence on English, I think what you have to do is you have to acknowledge that there's no single American English language and think about it in terms of dialects of English. And once you start thinking about that, a very interesting topic is so-called Indian English. And this is something that perplexed me for the longest time because I would hear people from different tribes speaking English. And these are all native speakers of English, most of whom don't even speak their ancestral language. So English is their first and only language. And there, I would notice these similarities in their pronunciation. Turns out that there's a guy named William Leap who's written on this topic. And I don't know that much about it. I'd really like to do more research on it. But one of the hypotheses is that Native American children for many, many decades were taken away from their families and put into these boarding schools. And the idea was that they would be acculturated into mainstream white society and that this would enable them to prosper and you know, just join mainstream society and everything would be great. Of course, they didn't factor in the little problem of racism. Mm-hmm. And so obviously what happened was they took these kids and they deprived them of their native cultures. And then the kids would go back to their native communities and they would be neither white nor Indian. Mm-hmm. So it was this horrible, horrible situation. Well, one of the main things that they did, one of the ways of the quote was take the Indian out of the Indian. I mean, it was just awful, was to punish them for using their languages. So what happened was you had people from all these different tribes sort of just plunked together into these boarding schools. And the hypothesis is that Indian English as a particular dialect of English grew out of the boarding school experience. And that's why you get people from very different tribes speaking in English that sounds actually somewhat the same. So there is a sense in which there is some kind of Native American influence on a particular dialect of English that it's very hard to pinpoint, but it's found throughout the United States. It's interesting thing.
How's that dialect characterized?
Oh, I knew you would ask me that. I don't actually know what the features of it are. It has something to do with the phonology, and I'm not mm-hmm. a good enough phonologist to be able to tell you, but I recommend William Leap's book. But there was one other thing that I was going to say, was that you obviously get borrowing the other direction. And so the American Indian languages, which are still spoken, have a lot of borrowings of English words in them. So back to Menominee, which I work on, the word for coffee is café. So there are various borrowings like that. And then you also get things where you would almost expect a borrowing and you don't get one. So the word for car, you would think there would be some kind of borrowing for the word for car, but they have a native word that they use, and it sort of means thing that you use to haul stuff, and it's not a borrowing at all.
You worked on a number of Native American languages, and you already mentioned Menominee, a language spoken by the members of the Menominee tribe right here in Wisconsin. As part of your research, you're also working on a dictionary of Menominee. That sounds like quite an enterprise. Is that the first dictionary of Menominee?
No, it's not. There is a dictionary that was compiled by the linguist Leonard Bloomfield. It was published in the 70s. He died in 1949, and so it was published by, obviously, someone else edited it and published it for him much later. It's simultaneously a wonderful and a horrible document. It's wonderful in the depth and the richness of what you can find in it. It's horrible, though, in that it's completely user-unfriendly. You have to know a huge amount about the sort of technical analysis of Menominee in order to be able to use the dictionary. Words are buried under other words. He writes things in a particular form that they don't always get pronounced in. He has a strange way of spelling things that is not how the tribe spells things now. So it's just a wonderful document to start from, and we've incorporated all of the words in that in our dictionary. But our dictionary is going to be user-friendly, we hope, and be something that the Menominee people will be able to use.
So how do you go about doing that? What are the challenges in your field work? You just walk in and ask people for words?
Well, not quite. There are some very interesting socio-political issues. You need to get permission. Mm-hmm. And working with the speakers, you have to show the appropriate respect for people. The Menominee tribe, for example, has a tribal language and culture code which decrees, among other things, that you have to pay the speakers a certain amount, really a high wage, which I think is a wonderful thing because what that does is that acknowledges how valuable their knowledge is.
Do people gladly participate?
Some do, some don't. That's a really interesting question. There is a group of elders who are speakers of the language who I've never met because they're not interested in working with a linguist. I think in some cases they probably feel like these linguists and anthropologists have come to our tribe for, you know, mm-hmm. over a century, and they come and they take stuff away and then they go away and we don't get anything for mm-hmm. it. So why should we cooperate with them? And there are others, I think, who feel like, well, the language is dying. It's not going to do anybody any good to learn it. Why don't we just let it die? And of course, that makes me very sad, but I have to respect that attitude. But there are other elders who see it as a living language and want it to continue. And those are the elders that I work with. I use English as a contact language, so I don't speak Menominee. So I sit there and I say, how do you say cow? How do you say chicken? How do you say, you know, he goes and picks strawberries. And
I recently interviewed Joan Hall, and what uh-huh. you're saying sounds very similar to what she said about compiling the Dictionary of American Regional
really?
English. But they had huge questionnaires, and
yeah.
it sometimes took about a week to have a whole questionnaire set filled.
Yeah. And, of course, you always think, well, you know, I'll make my huge lists of things that I'm going to ask, and then we only get through a tiny, tiny percentage of it because I ask a question like, you know, what's the word for X? And then we just go off in a long conversation about X, and we learn all sorts of cultural information about X, and, you know, and we learned about somebody's grandparents and what they did. And, you know, it's never a direct thing where I say, give me this word, give me this word, give me this mm-hmm. word. You know, it's always a conversation and it takes a long time, but I love that. I mean, it's one of the really delightful things about working with elderly people.
And who's your target audience for the dictionary?
Well, we're doing three versions. And the first is a beginner's dictionary, then an intermediate, and then a comprehensive. And the beginner's dictionary obviously is aimed at beginning learners of the language. So the Menominee are trying very hard to revitalize their language and bring it back. It's extremely endangered. I'm not really sure how many speakers there are, but maybe 10 to 20. And I'm talking fluent speakers who learned it as a first language. So it's taught in all of the schools on the reservation, and they don't have very good resources for teaching it. So this dictionary then would be a resource for teaching the language. The intermediate dictionary will be people who are a bit further advanced in it. I think it would also be useful to linguists who just want to know sort of what the basic words of the language are. The comprehensive, this is probably going to be my life's work, and I'll probably be 90 and it still won't be done, but the goal is to have pretty much all of the linguistic information about every word that we possibly can. So as I was saying before, the words are extremely complex, mm-hmm. so what we want to do is have the analysis of the words included so that you know what all the little pieces are in every single word. And I'm not sure we'll ever get there, but we're doing our best.
My last question touches on one of the big subjects in linguistics. That's a relationship between language and thought. We all know, or I hope we all know, that the Eskimo, or rather the Inuit, do not have hundreds of words for snow. But what if they did? What would it mean?
It wouldn't mean anything. All cultures are going to develop an extensive vocabulary for anything that's important to them. When I worked with the Mixtec on their language, they come from a culture which has corn as its staple food. And I discovered that there are parts of the corn that I didn't even know existed, and they have names in Mixtec. But this doesn't mean that a Mixtec person sees corn through different eyes than mm-hmm. I see corn. It's just that they make use of parts of corn that I didn't know existed, so they have names for it. So it really doesn't mean that much.
It has also been claimed that there are Native American languages that don't have tense, so they wouldn't have something like I go and I went, so you wouldn't encode that in the language, that one happens in the present and one happens in the past. And it has been claimed that this means that the passing of time must be experienced in very different ways by the speakers of these languages. In other words, the claim is that the perception of the world is shaped by the structure of the language. This is also known as the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, and I give a very simplified version of it. What is your take on that?
I think the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis in its strong form is definitely rejected by most sane linguists. The strong form of it would be that the language that you speak affects how you view the world. I think people are smarter than that. This notion that if a language doesn't have tense, people are not going to view the passing of time in the same way is absolutely ridiculous. there are languages that don't mark tense on their verbs, and that's what I think people mean when they say a language doesn't have tense. So when you take Spanish, you know, you learn here's the past tense and here's the future tense and blah, 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 and there are suffixes that go on the verbs that create these various tenses of the verbs. But there are lots of languages in the world that don't mark tense in that sense. Doesn't mean that they can't talk about the passage of time. They just do it in a different way. Mm-hmm. They use adverbs. They use other like little particles or various funny little words that you sort of sprinkle in. There's all sorts of ways of expressing things. And I really do firmly believe that any language can express anything. Now, having said that, I used to just have this complete absolute rejection of the Sapir Whorf hypothesis. But then I did some work on language and gender, and I started realizing that the weak version of the Sapir Whorf hypothesis maybe has some value. The weak version would be that the language that we use affects how we think about things unless we reflect and think carefully about them. So if you start looking at language and gender and you think about sexist language usage, there have been tons and tons of studies that have been done that show that the so-called generic he, you know, when man conquers mm-hmm. space, he will do such and such, actually does get interpreted as being masculine by people. And there are all sorts of psycholinguistic tests that show something along these lines. I think that this is a reflection of the weak version of the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, that if we don't stop and think about things like that, we may have that effect on our hearer. And so it's important to watch out for things like that. But the strong version, the thing that bothers me about the strong version is it sort of seems to assume that people are not very smart and they can't think beyond the boundaries of the words that their language uses. And that's why I think the weak version, yeah, maybe. The strong version, absolutely not.
Well, thanks for clearing that up.
Sorry, I feel very strongly about this, as you can tell.
Most linguists do, yeah. Thank you, Monica. And this concludes our podcast for today. I hope we could show that what some people consider primitive languages are actually languages of quite extraordinary complexity. And we're waiting for that dictionary to come out, even though it may not be in our lifetime. You can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Thank you.